The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about one thing we're going to talk about is this purge at CNN. You know, they're kind of getting the new management there wants to centrify the outfit, which is a kind of a funny thing since that already kind of is what CNN is. You know, you have Fox, which is Fox. You have MSNBC that has straight news from NBC News, but you know, their commentary and their celebrity hosts and stuff obviously vary from, you know, liberal to sort of cosmopolitan century, you know, kind of Morning Joe. So we're going to talk about that. We are also going to talk about this this case that has not gotten a lot of attention before the Supreme Court about Medicaid. You know, another one of these cases that may upend everything. And unlike Roe and Dobbs, which kind of like, that wasn't a surprise. People knew that was in the offing. This has gotten much less attention. My co-host Kate has done some reporting on it, so we're going to talk about that. Then we're also talk about the ongoing Mar-a-Lago drama. You know, it's funny when it is hard to see anything in retrospect without the long shadow of Trump. But obviously George W. Bush was a highly controversial president, to put it mildly, right? I mean, it was a pretty storm-tossed tenure. And then when he stopped being president, man, he went like into witness protection basically. Like nowhere. Right. And some of that was because, you know, by the time he left office, he was really unpopular. There was a big financial crisis at the tail end of his presidency. So kind of Republicans didn't want to have anything to do with him, basically. And in a very different way, when Barack Obama left office, you know, he was, you know, very loved by Democrats, still is very loved by Democrats, even though a lot of things have changed since his presidency. But he also basically disappeared. You know, he came out with, wait, God, I'm losing track now. I mean, he came out with a book. You know, he's around, but this is, you know, it's one of the features of the American presidency that you retire. You're not talking, I mean, obviously in two-term presidents can't run again, but you're kind of, you know, in theory, a president could say, I'm still young. I'm going to run for Senate. You know, I'm still in the game, but they really depart the scene, and even more than depart the scene. And this is something that has been for a long time was a great disappointment for Democrats in Bill Clinton. In the years during the Bush presidency, maybe even during the Obama presidency. If you remember, when Barack Obama ran for re-election, like the second night of his convention in 2012, was like Bill Clinton night. Bill Clinton coming in to kind of get everybody stirred up and explain the stakes and all that kind of stuff. And so a lot of people were disappointed, like, Bill, like, what? Come on, man. We're struggling here. We got the Iraq War. We got George W. Bush. Can you rally us a bit? You know, kind of get in there and give a few speeches. You know, use some of that old Clinton magic. And I remember at one point during the Bush presidency talking to someone who's kind of like a confidant of Clinton's. And like, sometimes people ask me this, like, you know, when you talk to Bill, Josh, like, dude, I don't talk to Bill. I met him maybe once or something like that. I, you know, never had a conversation with the guy. But this is someone who talked to, you know, like a really a, con, you know, confidant, maybe, you know, not Vernon Jordan, but, you know, someone who knows him, talks to him, and kind of say, you know, kind of like, hey, you really need to, you need to kind of get in the game. I can't remember what was going on at that moment, but, you know, you really need to kind of get in the game. You got to say something. This is serious. This is, again, no idea what it was. And as this person described it to me, Clinton's kind of like, hey, man, I'm part of the former president's club. I got bigger fish to fry than like whatever end of the world, financial crisis, Iraq war, you know, they kind of, this is sort of how their attitude is. And Barack Obama has been that way to a significant degree. They got, you know, Trump changes everything. Both Obamas were in the mix during that sort of virtual convention that Biden had in the summer of 2020. It's the pandemic seems so permanent now. It's weird to think that those conventions happened in the thick of it, you know, like July, August, or was it a little later, but, you know, way before vaccines, when, you know, when things were really still pretty bad. So anyway, but obviously all this is prologue to saying President Trump, former President Trump, ex-President Trump, as I like to call him, is not like that. He remains very much in the news. We're still going on and on about the search of his villa in Florida, which for some reason we're supposed to call by its name. Does your house have a name? My house does not have a name. I'm not going to tell you the address of my apartment, but it's just a number on a street in New York. It doesn't have a name. So anyway, the search of his villa, right? And that now this judge who he appointed like a year and a half or, I don't know, 2 years ago or whatever it is, with this special master thing, which is really, if she had said, no one disputes that attorney-client privilege is a real thing. It's a real thing for everybody. And I believe the government has said they did their own review of the stuff and they took out stuff that they think may fall under attorney-client privilege. If the judge would have said, look, I'm sure the government did their best, but this is very high profile. Let's have someone take another look just so everybody can feel like, you know, everything is on the up and up, blah, 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 blah. But she basically kind of invented this emeritus president executive privilege that completely doesn't exist. So we're going to talk about all those things. A little less high drama than we've had in some recent weeks, but not much. But before we get to that, let me remind you that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. It's hot, like too hot to put on real clothes and shoes to go out for iced coffee. But that doesn't mean you have to suffer without something delicious and cold to sip on. Get a Grady's Cold Brew beanbag kit delivered to your door and enjoy smooth, silky iced coffee without ever leaving the house. Each kit makes 36 glasses of iced coffee, which means you'll be ready to weather even the worst heat waves. And my God, this summer is you know, beyond heat wave, right? It's and extra terrifying since we know this isn't like really a heat wave. It's sort of like a heat preview. In any case, I don't want to bum you out about Grady's Cold Brew by climate catastrophism. But anyway, and with a price tag of just $1 a cup, you'll have money left over to splurge on a kiddie pool. Ready to feel the chill with every sip? Get 25% off at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. That's Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. Okay, co-host Kate Rigo, what is up?
Well, maybe let's start with the special master stuff because I think... time-wise, that is the most recent of the topics we're going to talk about today. So, and it, you know, it's interesting because all of this has really raised the profile of the judge who was behind this order that I think has been like pretty broadly just lambasted as kind of tortured reasoning or out and out kind of arguing for Trump, you know, as if she was one of his lawyers. But, you know, it's this Judge Cannon who
she is one of his lawyers.
Right. Who has not been in the job very long, who's a Federalist Society person, who was kind of selected for this job by the Team Trump, you know, and this is a dynamic that we've been talking about this show on the show and all these different, you know, different kind of cases and venues. But the judge shopping continues apace, and there seems to be no recourse at all for kind of delivering cases to the most sympathetic judge you can find. And in this case, it's kind of a double whammy because, you know, not that I think they would have been able to get out of the state of Florida, but the appeals court we're dealing with now is the 11th Circuit, which has been, you know, pretty rapidly Trumpified. He appointed, I think, 6 of the 11 total judges there. So that kind of complicates next steps as well. But, you know, so she put out this order after Trump belatedly asked for a special master to go through the papers that the FBI took. But I think one of the first egregious points of this ruling is she granted this order, which the government was kind of like, well, you're too late, bub. Our team already went through it. Like, if you're going to make this request, you have to do it right away. So there was this delay. And then she granted it, which she previewed that she was probably going to do before she even let the government get their arguments in, you know, so we kind of knew what we were dealing with there. But so she granted it and said that the special master can go through with an eye to attorney-client privilege, which is like, okay, fine. I mean, the government did that as well, kind of put aside documents that might threaten that dynamic, but also with an eye towards what executive privilege can cover, which, you know, just start a whole firestorm from legal analysis who were basically like, what executive privilege? And meanwhile, she also said that the DOJ had to stop its investigation while they kind of figure out this special master situation, which is further complicated by the fact that a lot of these documents are classified. And the Trump lawyer team already said they want the special master to have at least top secret clearance to go through it. So all of this to say, it's this big hodgepodge mess of like a Federalist Society, you know, ordered judge kind of doing the yeoman's work for Team Trump. And now we're kind of waiting to see, is the DOJ going to appeal, you know, whole hog to the 11th Circuit, which, as we say, is by no means, I think, a slam dunk that it'll side with the government. Is it going to appeal part of the decision? Maybe the part that says their investigation has to just grind to a halt while they figure this out, which obviously lays all kinds of potential witnesses open to being, you know, coerced or tampered with. So, yeah, that's the mess we're in.
Yeah, there's quite a few things here. And one thing is, and I don't want to get the exact details wrong, the law is pretty clear that everything tied to the Presidential Records Act and this kind of whole thing, that those have to go through the D.C. Circuit. So it really, and the judge here acknowledged that and said, okay, but I'm going to rule on it anyway. And I think that the technicality here is that this... It's basically Trump did it as a civil action, that it's about the warrant. It's not about the case. So there are these technicalities that is keeping it in Florida, in the 11th Circuit, all that kind of stuff. So there are various ways, you know, among the different things that the government could do, it could take some actions that just kind of at least should pull it up into DC. The other thing, though, in like one thing about like, I think if they got like the national, if they got the archivist of the National Archives to sort of do something, you know, there's all these technicalities about jurisdiction and stuff. And, you know, there was already a judge dealing with this in Florida, and Trump went, you know, he didn't go next door. He went several blocks away to find this judge. And, you know, in general, you're not supposed to be able to do that. And to some extent, this is on the government because they could have said, hey, no, you have to, you know, this isn't where this should be. I think they kind of saw that as if the judge doesn't agree, if some other appellate court doesn't agree, then you're stuck with this judge who you you know, sort of insulted or, you know, whatever. But in this, not only did the judge go ahead with this special master thing, not only did she create this phony executive privilege concept that ex-presidents are supposed to have, there were a lot of other things in the decision that basically just special treatment for Trump. You know, in general, when you get to trial, you have a presumption of innocence, right? That's the system. You don't have a presumption of innocence during the investigation. Now, there's no need for a presumption of innocence because no one's saying you're not innocent. The government's collecting evidence, basically. But what she has done in a sort of a global sense is to say, is to kind of create that, to create the kinds of strictures, the kinds of scrutiny that is usually applied to, can you use it in court against Trump? Right. So there are certain cases where you'd say, OK, the search was defective, so I'm not going to let you use this one thing you found at trial. You know, because that's sort of the framework. It is, you know, much less common that you say, OK, I'm not going to let you use it to even look at, to investigate. So there's that whole thing. And then there were a number of assertions that the judge made, which basically say that it's not fair because the government and Trump are not on equal terms here in this process. Well, that's not a thing. The government that's not a thing at all. There are certain rights you have. You don't have rights to basically have the rights of being on trial when the government's just investigating what you did. This is just basic stuff. And she also had lines in there kind of relatedly on this kind of fairness equity front, saying that Trump's a former president and this is really embarrassing for him. So, you know, there's a huge stigma, and this is more than, you know, the stigma you are imposing on Trump. This isn't like some crack dealer who's just some, you know, kind of scum of the earth who doesn't matter if you raid his house and take his stuff and whatever. This is Trump. So this is serious. Well, okay. That's not a thing, right? I mean, it's sort of like if Donald Trump, as a former president, acted in such a way that the FBI needed to conduct a court-ordered search of his house, that's on Trump. Yeah, that is kind of embarrassing. He's the first one this has ever happened to. But, you know, don't do bad things. Right?
Well, let me read that quote. I pulled it from the filing just so our listeners can see that you're not even being hyperbolic in here. She says, as a function of the plaintiff's former position as president of the United States, the stigma associated with the subject seizure is in a league of its own. A future indictment based to any degree on property that ought to be returned would result in reputational harm of a decidedly different order of magnitude. Like, that kills me. You know, should an indictment occur, right? Should this investigation turn up enough evidence that the government chooses to indict a former president? Well, that would suck for the former president.
And
so we should keep that front of mind. Right.
Yeah. It's
which
a
is
stigma.
Like, right. That's the most important dynamic going on here for sure, is his kind of emotional well-being.
Well, and also the idea that he needs new protections commensurate with the level of his disgrace.
Yeah.
I mean, it is true. It's a much bigger, you know, a drug dealer, a drug trafficker down in Miami. If that person gets raided and they get indicted, as long as they don't get convicted, they're probably not worrying about it. You know, it's more cred for them. There's no reputational thing. But because Trump's a former president, he needs more protection. But again, no, right? I mean, kind of like, it's on you that you became president and then broke a lot of laws. You don't need special protection. If anything, you should be held to a higher standard. But like, you know, presumably we should all be able to agree on just like, you get treated like everybody else.
Right. So
there you go.
What's your best guess of where DOJ goes from here?
Well, I certainly hope they appeal it in whatever the most advantageous way. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if that's, you get it back into DC, you go into the appellate judges in the 11th Circuit. I think they really need to appeal the whole thing, or appeal all of the erroneous parts of it, because if you can't validate a decision that is this off. Mm-hmm. It's basically saying Trump, as an ex-president, continues to be above the law, continues to need, you know, all sorts of special protections from the law. So I don't think you can, you know, a normal logic might be, hey, don't piss off the judge. She wants to do this special master thing, delay it for a while, you know, whatever, no harm. I really don't think you can do that here to validate this. And you need to find out pretty quickly, like, is the 11th Circuit going to sign off on this? Right. And if the 11th Circuit does, is the Supreme Court going to? Now, again, you have a lot of kind of traditionally minded lawyers say, oh, don't set a bad precedent. Well, that is foolish thinking, that frankly, far too many of, you know, kind of elite Democratic liberal lawyers are still thinking in those terms. We need to know what the actual rules we're operating under. We really don't have the luxury of worrying about precedents for the future, because this is the future. We need to know, you know, and if it turns out that the federal judiciary in its current corrupted state basically will not allow investigations into Donald Trump in cases where, I mean, they've already got the goods. They found the stuff. He stole the stuff. They found the stolen stuff in his house. So this isn't a fishing expedition. I mean, he's guilty, right? I mean, you need to go to trial. But if they won't allow prosecutorial work like this, where he's basically caught red-handed, let's know that now. And then we can sort of operate on that basis, and, you know, kind of take things to the next level, which is, you know, basically needing to reform the federal judiciary. But let's not, it's important, I think, not to screw around and be, you know, led around like fools with these kind of bogus decisions. So they need to appeal the whole thing. I suspect they will. And I, you know, we're going to find out pretty soon, because in the judge's order, she basically wanted them to come forward with, you know, kind of nominating potential special masters by Friday. So they need to do this basically today or tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, in another piece of this, just to make it explicit, while she kind of ordered the DOJ's investigation to a halt, she explicitly said that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence can continue reviewing the documents, you know, for its damage assessment, which is a process DOJ has been involved in up till this point. So even that idea of, like, you know, DOJ has to stop, this agency can go forward. I mean, the whole thing is just, like, totally incoherent and nonsensical. So, you know, even in terms of logistics, I totally agree with you on the precedent piece, but, you know, on logistics as well, I really think if they just let this whole process play out, and you know that Team Trump is going to drag it out and contest any special master and try to, I mean, that's not nothing, having huge months-long delay in a case like this, when we know Trump is gearing up to run in 2024. This stuff is important.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, yeah, the Democrats took over the House in January 2019, and we are still basically seemingly late in the process of getting the House getting access to his tax returns. So that's going to be four years later. And some of that you can legitimately criticize the government, the administration, the House for not being sufficiently aggressive. But, you know, this is always his thing. Just delay, delay, delay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's his MO.
Okay, so let's shift gears now and talk about the CNN purge that you previewed in the intro, Josh. The highest profile departures of late were Brian Stelter from Reliable Sources, and then John Harwood, who White House, right? He was the chief White House correspondent.
White House correspondent. And he had been at New York Times and CNBC and then,
And similarly to Selter, also had 2 more years left on the contract, which, you know, made everybody pay attention and think that this was less these people kind of seeking a new, maybe perhaps less intensive or less TV heavy job and much more. This is sending a message. You know, this was kind of done intentionally to raise people's ears to this situation and probably intentionally to kind of get a message across to the CNN staff as well.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, we were talking about this before we went on air. There's no reason to pretend that we don't know that there is a purge of some sort going on at CNN. They're basically open about it. They're under new management. The sort of the top board member is a very conservative Trump donor, you know, Republican telecom mogul. The person who runs the sort of the umbrella company is also in that mold. The guy who actually runs CNN now, Chris Licht is his name. I'm not sure of his exact, you know, politics, but he has been sent in with the mission to make CNN more centrist, to stop it being so liberal. Now, I think a lot of us would kind of challenge that premise. But regardless of whether you challenge the premise, they're getting rid of the people who are, you know, in any way perceived as not friendly enough to Trump. And, you know, one article I saw about this saying that John Malone, the guy who, you know, the sort of the telecom bigwig kind of, you know, who's the ultimate guy we're calling the shots now, you know, says that his knowledge of CNN seems all to be via Fox. Right. So, you know, sort of the bad guy list on Fox of who the bad people are on CNN. So it's obvious this is happening. I think we know why it's happening. It's happening, you know, to a great extent, just because, again, under new management, in a broader sense, they are reacting to the fact that this has been the case for a couple decades, but it's been accelerated and intensified under Trump. Either you are with Trump or you're against him. So with him 100% or you're fake news. And if you are fake news, basically you become suspect, if not verboten, for, you know, a big plurality of the country, Red America. And a company like CNN, owned by a company like the one that owns it, it's like Warner Brothers Discovery now or something like that. The point of that business is not to have a potential purchase on half the population. You want to have the whole market, right? If you're like, you know, Kellogg's, your point is not to sell cereal to like a potential market of 45% of the population. You wouldn't have a potential market of everyone. So it's both of these things together. And what Kate and I were talking about before we went on the air with our colleague Jackie was that these firings it's clear that in each case, the person who was fired got a call that basically says, you're out today. Bye. You're fired. I think they gave Brian Stelter, you know, called him midweek. And the last show of Reliable Sources was Sunday. He got to do one final episode and that's it. And then with John Harwood, it seemed, again, no notice. You know, he may have picked up some hints, but they're doing this in a way. There's a way in which if you no longer want someone to work with you, and certainly in that very public context, people have contracts and all this kind of stuff. There are ways you handle it and say, you know, where the head of the company calls in Brian Stelter and says, look, we're moving in a different direction. Let's find a way over the next few months. You look for something else. We'll negotiate about the contract and, you know, you're moving ahead. These firings were clearly done in a way that they are going to immediately go to Fox. And that everybody is going to see. Was there any question that Brian Stelter just decided he didn't want to run a show anymore? No. He was fired. He was fired, and he was fired because he's not friendly enough to Trump. So they're doing these firings in a way, not just because they want to get rid of these people. And I'm sure there's more. Every few weeks, there's another. So it puts everyone on edge in the organization. they are done so that the people who they are trying to cater to, obviously Trump Republicans, can see it and guffaw and chortle and laugh and have sort of schadenfreude at these people's expense. So it's all by design. It's all by design.
So the thing that is fundamentally baffling to me about this is, I think what you said is right. This idea that they want to cater to this like greater, you know, to all of Americans is the goal, right? Like they don't want to be the same entity that was particularly hated by Trump and kind of his number one target in terms of, you know, fake lamestream news, blah, blah, blah. But that idea is just so like ancient by today's media standards. It's almost like they're operating like it's 1990 and, you know, there's no internet and the cable news networks have huge, you know, sway over people and are kind of the arbiters of opinion and all this stuff. It's like they're acting like they're in that landscape. Whereas there, I think there is fundamentally nothing that CNN could do that would make the Trump segment of the population like them or trust them. I mean, I think they could go kind of full Fox. And I think the Trump people would, similarly to how you just described, like it, laugh about it, say, look, even CNN is backing our boy now. That is not the same thing as getting those people to be like, you know who I trust? You know, the news source that's really just sterling, top of the line, CNN. Like, that's not going to happen. So instead, what they're doing here, and which we've seen so many of the kind of big mainstream outlets kind of do as they try to find their footing in a Trump-dominated era, is it just become this like mealy-mouthed, centrist, you know, vessel for what we've talked about on the show a lot are just fundamentally untruths, because there is just no longer a way to do these parties are the same, they're both political thing, without like fundamentally lying about the biggest threat to democracy that we're dealing with. So I just think even the goal is just like, are you living in the same world that we're living in? How do you intend to do this?
Yeah, no, I mean, to a great extent, just the Republican Party, not just Trump, but the sort of the evolution of our political culture has made that thing almost impossible. And the reason there is so much focus on CNN from the Trump types, I mean, you don't hear, they do a little, but generally speaking, you don't hear the Trump people getting all upset about MSNBC, because MSNBC has sort of identified itself as, mm-hmm. you know, the liberal network. You know, they have the straight news, whatever, but basically everybody's conceded that. So there's kind of no, so, but that's what makes CNN such a problem, because it's not supposed to be either one. So that's why there's, you know, constant, oh, CNN fake news, ah, this blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, the Trump types are not looking for, they're not even looking for CNN to become more centrist. I mean, you can imagine a very kind of straight news reading CNN. Right. Where we're going to, you know, Caitlin Collins, who's going to give us a kind of an update from what just happened at the White House. We're going to go to the Pentagon course, you know, just very straight, not even, you know, very news copy reading kind of thing. That's not what they want. They want CNN there as the thing to beat up on. Mm-hmm. And they want CNN there as the thing to beat up on. And then is trying to cater, but it's never enough. Oh, you fired Brian Stelter? Well, what about this guy? Like, even CNN, because CNN sees they have to curry to the big guy. It's all part of that, you know, Trumpian, drama and ecosystem of they're the bad guys who hate us, who you need to hate. But even they see how strong we are. So they're starting to cater us, but it's never going to be enough because they're still blah, blah, blah. You know, you're right that there is nothing that they are going to do that is going to make Republicans or Trump or any of Trump's people think, I used to think they were fake news, but they're pretty solid now.
Yep.
Go CNN. I mean, that's not,
exactly.
You know, they could do that if they literally rebranded as Fox News. They would still be saying, we brought them to heel. But, you know, there's already a market for that. And it's funny that one of the things that, to the extent this is an economic thing, the people at Time Warner Discovery, again, I think that's the latest name of the shell company, or the umbrella company, saying, look, Fox has just a much bigger audience. We want that big audience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does have a much bigger audience, but that's kind of because that's how, you know, conservatives consume news differently.
Exactly.
But Fox is already there, right? Fox is already there.
Right.
So
I was thinking that through as well. Like, if you kind of, because you can take it at, take this whole happening from two angles, right? You can take it just from the kind of like desire to rebrand, and then you take it from the economic. And on the economic side, I just think you're right. It's like, even if CNN went full Fox, I mean, at best, they'll be like a pale imitation of Fox. No Fox loyalists are going to be like, never mind, I'm going to go to this like new CNN. And that's just not going to happen, you know? So it's like, you're just making yourself suck more to appeal to this kind of like imaginary slice of people who would love CNN if only it were just a tad easier on the former president.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, look, there certainly is. They've got more opinion-y. You know, I don't need the opinion-y part of CNN. That's not, I kind of, CNN is where when I was younger, I was totally addicted to political TV. I mean, I watched all the shows in the evening. I wrote about it, blah, 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 blah. I watch very, very, very little political TV. I flip it on when there's stuff, kind of big stuff happening. And I always watch CNN because it's basically straight news, right? I mean, I love a lot of the people on MSNBC. I mean, literally a number of the hosts are friends of mine who I love, but I already know what they think. I don't need to hear what they think. I'm trying to consume news. So it's a different, it's not saying one is better than the other. It's just my needs, basically what I'm trying to accomplish. The whole thing is silly, basically. They're not gonna I think the most they will accomplish is to get some, you know, to kind of say like, oh, they've shaken things up. They mm-hmm. kind of realized they were too liberal but I don't think that's gonna accomplish a lot.
Yeah. I mean, and I think in terms of the kind of news opinion dichotomy, like there's this one quote from the guy you mentioned, John Malone, who's, you know, the big pocketed board member who's seemingly kind of behind a lot of this shift, where he said, you know, he praised Fox News for having, quote, followed an interesting trajectory of trying to have news, I mean, some actual journalism embedded in a program schedule of all opinions, which, you know, I would say is a pretty generous assessment of what Fox News has done. And also just like a bizarre reading of kind of, I think, you know, where their bread is buttered, as if this idea of like, well, they kind of got themselves a lot more gravitas when they brought on, you know, Chris Wallace or whatever, like the few sane people. And that made a big difference on the network. And it's kind of like, did it?
I mean, people
sometimes give cover to the more like, you know, Maria Bartolomeo, Judge Jeanine stuff. But I mean, that's what they are. That's their soul.
Yeah. I mean, and the funny thing is, it's not even like, you know, Chris Wallace was there for a long time. Like, it's like he wasn't brought in to kind of like,
exactly.
Oh, okay, we got Judge Jeanine, but we're going to have, you know, some real people. I mean, the real people were there longer, right? And needless to say, Chris Wallace is not there anymore. He works for CNN now, and not, you know, not by accident. So, you know, look, this is one of the many reasons why you want, it sounds very paternalistic, but ideally, you have news organizations that are owned either by, you know, very wealthy individuals who are not seeing them primarily as profit plays, or by families. And obviously, there's all sorts of negative things that go along with that, that speak for themselves. But you want someone who is committed to the product. And not seeing the enterprise, you know, purely as a financial play. You know, Rupert Murdoch is committed to the product, and the product sucks, but it keeps Fox on mission, right? And in a case like this, this is just fallout from the sell-off of Time Warner, splitting up its various kinds of properties, that CNN ended up in this new company, and it's run by this guy John Malone, and he's a right winger, and this is what he wants, and you know, that's not great for a news organization. You know, it's you've got the Sulzberger family, you know, tons of problems with them, but you know, and look, they're not doing it for charity. They're super wealthy. It's not that it's, you know, news organizations should make money, but usually those kind of owners' families are willing to just make money, but not trying to kind of leverage them and sell them off for more money. You know, all this kind of stuff where it's purely seeing it as a financial asset.
Yep.
Let me just add one thing. Not to obviously, we're talking organizations at a vastly different scale, mm-hmm. but think about TPM. I am, there's a few other minor outside investors. My wife and I own the great majority of TPM. We basically own TPM. You know, it's been, I have a comfortable living. It's great, right? It's awesome and all that stuff. If TPM were a financial proposition, it would have sold it 15 years ago to someone else. It wouldn't have made sense to keep doing it. The money that went into it would have been more profitably gone somewhere else. This isn't charity. I mean, I'm here in my, you know, I wish it were larger, but my New York City apartment. But my point is, you want owners who want the organization to follow its mission. If it works out, they'll also make a nice living. But you want it to be that they're motivating goal is the product, to be a news organization, to be a certain kind of news organization. And when you have, you know, we've rebuilt the business model of this organization two or three times over the last 15 years. It's a huge amount of hard work. It made more sense to do something different. But the people who, myself, but also the kind of the core people involved in the organization, we really want there to be a TPM. And that's why there is a TPM. And that same basic logic applies to the vastly larger and more significant and more consequential news organizations. Again, I think about the New York Times. Clearly, the Sulzberger family was very committed to being the owners of the New York Times and to having there be a New York Times in a way that was not purely financial, even though, again, they lived the high life, all that great stuff. When you have an organization, you know, it would be much better if Ted Turner still owned and ran TPM, even though he's a bit of a weirdo. And I mean that in a nice sense, right? You want individual people who are committed to the product.
Okay, so to finish our episode, we'll talk about this Supreme Court case, which I kind of came about because we had, you know, a pretty like high profile lawyer who, you know, I chat with sometimes kind of like brought my attention to it. And I've been going over the docket for next term because, believe it or not, that starts in October. So we are, you know, right back into it, trying to figure out where we want to kind of pinpoint our attention and our energy. And it's funny because some cases have gotten already quite a bit of ink. You know, we're going to have the two affirmative action cases, you know, one from a public university and one from a private. Lots of people have written about those. There's a voting rights case that's going to be interesting and all this kind of stuff. But this one, it's funny because I was researching around before I started, you know, working on this story, and basically nothing outside of like the more trade oriented publications, you know, kind of health publications or specifically kind of health law venues. It just has gotten very little kind of popular news crossover, which just stands in such stark contrast to when I was making calls for this story. And every single person, 201, was like, yeah, this is the most important case of my lifetime. Or almost all of them kind of unprompted said, you know, this case is to Medicaid what Dobbs was to abortion. It's a huge, huge case that is just really going under the radar. And I asked them, why do you think that is? Why do you think this has gotten so few headlines? And they were all just kind of like, well, you know, this always happens with Medicaid stuff, partially because when you think Medicaid, you think poor people, and poor people's issues rarely get the attention that, you know, rich people issues do. And then also Medicaid law is like very confusing and kind of layered up in all the case law. There's some, murkiness. And like with this in particular, there, I mean, I had to be walked through two different sets of like factor tests that courts use for this kind of case. So, I mean, it's not straightforward. But the upshot of it is, this case gives the conservative majority a chance to kind of close the pathway that beneficiaries of federal programs use to sue when their rights are being violated. So Medicaid's the biggest one, but a decision in this case could apply to everything that's kind of federally funded and state administered. So that also includes, you know, things like SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, a lot of those kind of programs, which kind of form the brunt of our social safety net. And by closing this pathway to sue, there is just almost no recourse left for any accountability for if, say, Texas decides, well, we don't want to cover children anymore under Medicaid. Like, that's expensive. We'd rather use the money on something else. We're just not going to do it. The best pathway to forcing them into compliance are these called Section 1983 lawsuits, which the beneficiaries can file under. It goes to federal court. And that's pretty much the best way to do it, because the federal government is just kind of shockingly unarmed in these cases. They can send letters, but their biggest weapon is basically just to pull the funding, to say, well, we're not going to, there goes your Medicaid funding, which obviously is probably not the best outcome for beneficiaries who are already not receiving the services they've been promised.
And then presumably, in some cases, if you're dealing with a red state governor, they'll say, cool. Like, okay. Like, they're in a lot of cases, they're not. I mean, often when it comes, when you get down to specifics, even very red state governors, you know, you have to keep the state running.
Yep.
You have to be able to fund hospitals. You know, hospitals are not allowed to turn away people in need of medical care, blah, 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 blah. Answer me this. So, okay. So with the case of covering kids, where is, now I think what most of us would think is, okay, you know, Medicaid does X, Y, and Z, and that's written down in some law somewhere. Mm-hmm. If Texas decides, okay, we're not going to do it, aren't they just breaking the law?
Yeah.
I mean, so there's not really much question about they're not following the law, but just the question is how you compel them to follow the law.
Exactly. Right.
And the federal government's only lever is basically to say, just take away the money.
Right. Pretty much just the nuclear option, which is why these lawsuits are so important. And also because part of this is, think of the range of kind of Medicaid, of venues that interact with Medicaid, right? We're talking like nursing homes and doctor's offices and hospitals. It's just a lot of stuff. And right now, about 90 million Americans are enrolled in Medicaid. So that's a lot. And partially a reason why these lawsuits
like
are so
important. Of the country.
Exactly. And a reason why these lawsuits are so important is because they raise kind of red flags to HHS and the Center for Medicaid Services of kind of who the biggest violators are, like where they need to kind of focus their policing and figure out where to center that attention. And as it is, granted, this pathway is good and it's really important, but you're asking a Medicaid beneficiary, usually poor, or at least often kind of vulnerable in other ways, elderly, disabled, pregnant, you're asking them, your recourse to get your rights restored are to file a lawsuit in federal court under this, you know, provision of this very old Reconstruction era law. I mean, the only recourse we're giving people in general is to have a legal battle in federal court, right? I don't think most people would say like that's the perfect easy remedy for a normal person. But that's what we got.
Well, presumably often you have social aid, social mm-hmm. services, law firms and so forth that are taking up these cases, right? I mean, as you say, I mean, someone who's like an indigent person who needs, you know, kidney dialysis is not, you know, they've mm-hmm. their hands are full. They're not going to, you know, a litigation individually isn't going to make a lot of sense for them.
Right. And so a piece of this that one expert kind of brought up to me as worrying is that in some of the Dobbs stuff, Alito specifically took issue with a dynamic where providers kind of sue on behalf of their patients, or they're kind of the motivating force behind the lawsuits. Like mm-hmm. he kind of specifically pinpointed that. And that's a dynamic that's very present in these Medicaid cases, that often it is kind of, you know, doctors or long-term care workers who see that, you know, this state has to provide this to its Medicare enrollees, and it's just not.
Right, right,
or Medicaid,
right.
Excuse me.
Now, what is in one of the features of the Roberts Court, which has sort of gotten out of Roberts' hands over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, is you have things that have been settled law for decades, even centuries in some cases. And like for a contrary example, you mentioned before, there are these affirmative action cases that are going to mm-hmm. come before the court. Courts have been wrestling with affirmative action for about half a century. So these are not new issues. We may not like the direction they're going, but I mean, these have been contested issues for a very long time. Where the Roberts Court has really gone to town are these cases of something is just kind of settled law or settled federal powers. And they come along and say, oh, turns out we got this new theory that you can't do this. And, you know, the whole thing with Obamacare and a mandate, are you allowed to have a mandate in that kind of case? And, you know, that was, they made their arguments, but the idea that the federal government couldn't do something like that just had not, no one had given that serious consideration. So in this case, what is the novel theory that is driving this?
It's funny because it is a novel theory, but it's one that they've kind of trotted out a lot, it seems, right? We haven't seen what the Supreme Court kind of thinks of this, but it seems like what they're going to do is go back to this argument they've used time and time again, which is that Congress wasn't explicit enough in the kind of underlying law that governs this, that it's been, agencies have interpreted it, you know, much more broadly than it's anticipated. This kind of, it's part of this ongoing war against the administrative state, against powerful regulatory agencies. And then it's easy to rest on this argument of, well, easy remedy. If Congress wants to be more explicit, they can go ahead, you know, very much knowing that the Senate at least is near inoperable on kind of big legislative questions, especially when you need any kind of Republican support on them. So
similar to what we had in the climate change EPA mm-hmm. litigation, where they've said, hey, we're not saying the federal government can't do this, but federal government can't write a very general law and then leave it up to these agencies to kind of do this. We need to see a specific provision in a revised law that says you can sue if you're not getting the Medicaid coverage you're entitled to.
Right. And, you know, the thing is that, speaking of kind of well-established law, so this, the section 1983 that these claims come under, this is from, this is from like Reconstruction era. Basically, this law was part of a civil rights package that was passed because to protect newly freed slaves from being terrorized by officials operating under state color. The idea that if that's happening to you, you can take your case to federal court and get a fair hearing. And it's basically, in a lot of ways, lay dormant for a long time, even though now it's interesting because one of the most common Section 1983 actions is in these high profile cases of police brutality and police killing of Black men. But, you know, since like 70s, 80s, it's been expanded to not only include constitutional rights, but also statutory rights, and then squarely applied to Medicaid. So there is just a lot of kind of case law here that this applies to spending legislation and that there are private rights of action underneath them. But the experts have just kind of been reading the tea leaves for a while that these, you know, as the court has become more conservative in the last, you know, I guess maybe decade and a half, it started making the conditions upon where you can bring these lawsuits narrower and kind of increasing the burden on the person who's bringing suit. So in that way, there is a long paper trail of people like Roberts especially, but also, you know, Alito, Thomas, kind of the usual suspects, really not liking these kind of lawsuits and indicating in earlier writings that they would be happy if the court kind of steered away from them. So the fact that now they're taking up what is kind of a garden variety, one of these cases where a nursing home inhabitant, his family is saying that he was mistreated, So the fact that they're kind of taking that up is just raising flags in the same way that Dobbs did, right? That was a 15-week gestational ban out of Mississippi. There was nothing new about that ban. There was not like lower court schisms or anything like that. That was just ominous to people in the same way that this one is now.
And it's true that that people, because he has mildly dissented on some of these high profile things, people think he is not as conservative as he is. He's extremely conservative. And these are the kinds of cases that Roberts really goes to town on. This is the stuff, this administrative state stuff. Basically, you have to have specific laws. You can't have these independent regulatory agencies that are given a broad, remit, and then they kind of just come up with stuff. It also reminds us, though, of the damage that is caused by the legislative filibuster. Because on its face, the argument that they make, just pass a law, makes a certain amount of sense. That, you know, don't say we're kind of like, that this is judicial tyranny. If the American public really wants this to happen, just go ahead and pass a law and it's all cool. Well, there's a number of different problems with that, but there's a certain logic, and this is how you get minority government. If you have in effect created a system where you need a supermajority to do anything. So it brings us back to that,
which is all just so convenient, right? Because it lets the conservative justices say we should shift the power back to the people's representatives, right? The most democratic branch. But if the most democratic branch isn't actually operating, that just leaves the judiciary as an outsized source of power, kind of just 9 unelected people, making their will law or slapping down laws because it isn't in keeping with their vision of what the regulatory system should be like. And it's interesting in this case because the DOJ filed a brief kind of asking the court, it seems to me, to be kind of providing an off ramp that would lead them, give them a way to do some damage without whole hog kind of shredding this section 1983 under which these claims are made. They're basically saying, well, reduce the rights of nursing home patients, basically, under the kind of like Medicaid agreement, but don't touch the private right of action thing. And one expert I was talking to kind of theorized that she thinks that's because in Dobbs, there was no, the government's position was kind of wholly
yes or no.
Shoot down the gestational ban, uphold Roe. And, I'm not super convinced that if they had said, oh, we're cool with the 15-week gestational ban, just go that way, and said that the justices would have bit. But there is clearly in this case an effort to kind of try to appeal to the more, quote unquote, centrist of the court's right wing to be like, here, you can still, make a few people suffer, but like not as many as you would.
right. Yeah, no, I mean, that strategy does, fit into what I think many of us think is the broad misunderstanding of where the federal judiciary is right now. At the same time, this is not a politicized issue in the same way.
Right.
So it can be, I wouldn't say there's room for compromise precisely, but, there's no big organized constituency saying, oh, regulatory agencies, fuck that, man. I've been in the trenches for decades marching about regulatory rulemaking. No actual voters even know what's happening here. Right. I mean, so it's a John Roberts type, although obviously they need more than Roberts at this point. You can kind of say like, OK, let's not overturn everything. Right. Let's just kind of nudge it in the right direction. The dynamics of it are a little different than with abortion.
Yeah, though, I mean, the anti-administrative state thing is such like a Federalist Society hobby horse that it really kind of incredible, like how in that sphere, which I totally agree with you, voters like don't know what's going on. I think the phrase administrative state, whenever I write articles about this, I have to keep it out of the headlines so people will actually click on it. But, it is just the underpinnings of our society.
And you're right that it is a huge holy grail for the Federalist Society mm-hmm. people. But what's different is that, you know, Federalist Society is like a few thousand like nerd lawyers.
Totally. Yep.
Right. Who like reading National Review. Abortion, obviously, even though the pro-life cause is a minority viewpoint and a shrinking minority viewpoint, you still have like 35% of the population who's totally gung-ho about that, mm-hmm. totally gung-ho. And if you are a Republican politician, that's like 60-65% of your voters. So it's a big deal. There's a big mass constituency who, and you know, that look, that's why that leak happened almost certainly last spring, because the pro-life activists wanted everybody to know that, you know, I'm forgetting Kavanaugh's first name, Brett Kavanaugh, that Brett Kavanaugh had the thing in his sights. Right. He had the big fish on the line. And if he was going to let it get away, he was never going to be forgiven. And that was, you know, whether he would have let it get away at all, I have my doubts. But that was at least so the dynamics are different. So we'll see.
Totally.
But again, another reason to get rid of the filibuster, which I have relative confidence is going to happen in the next few years, if not sooner.
Well, on that hopeful note.
Yeah. Hopeful. Let me remind you that the Josh Marshall Podcast brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get 25% off at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM.
All right. See you next week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.